Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Needs Some Introduction. In today's episode, I will be breaking down the career of Guy Ritchie and the interesting parallel he's had with his production partner, Matthew Vaughn. At the moment, Guy Ritchie not only has had a very successful Netflix series, The Gentlemen, his own adaptation of his film, but just this week, the Matthew Vaughn film Argylle premiered on Apple TV+. And the recently very prolific Guy Ritchie also has The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare playing in theaters right now. And these two filmmakers have a very interesting career trajectory where almost exclusively one is having success while the other is not. And I find that an interesting parallel. Also very interesting in seeing The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare in the same week that I finally caught up with Argylle, both films that feature Henry Cavill trading barbs with a burly sidekick, and how much more successful one film is versus the other. So Ritchie dropped out of school when he was only 15 years old. He apparently kept getting into trouble, had girls up in his room, apparently was the main reason he was kicked out. But he was never a good student and suffered from dyslexia. I think his parents were working class, but interestingly, both of them eventually married into royalty. And maybe this is some of the fixation he has in his films between the posh meets underclass cultural collisions that often happen in his films. Even at an early age, pretty soon he started to find himself gravitating to the film industry and just working on any kind of menial task on film or music video production. And Britain was about to have a much bigger footprint in the international movie market, coming off of Four Weddings and a Funeral, the huge international success of that film, as well as The Full Monty, another huge hit, which had all followed up on the surprise success of The Crying Game. And of course, Danny Boyle's Trainspotting had come out in 1996. So Ritchie had slowly worked his way up on the productions he had worked on, had started to direct some music videos, and had befriended Matthew Vaughn, who was the godson of Peter Morton, who's one of the founders of the Hard Rock Cafe. And through this friendship and through his movie connections and through family connections to Trudy Styler, Sting's wife, they eventually got Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels produced in 1998. A minor hit in the United States, although a huge hit when it eventually premiered on home video, internationally, this was a big hit, especially back in England. He was immediately a cult hero. For me, this film is a great calling card, and you see almost all of his strengths on display right away. Of course, we meet Jason Statham for the first time. He'll become a huge star in the next decades. Vinnie Jones is here and comes back for the Gentlemen TV series, by the way. But more importantly is what he brings to Lock, Stock as far as this particular style, this hyperkinetic action that is simultaneously thrilling and slapstick. There's this nonchalant coolness among all his characters. And I think a secret weapon here always is that he's able to simultaneously create this sense of danger, real stakes for the characters, and yet it feels so light and frothy and funny. So there definitely are stakes, and yet we're able to laugh even in the worst of moments because there's this strange balancing act, something that very few filmmakers can pull off, not even Quentin Tarantino. He obviously is inspired by Tarantino, but even Tarantino doesn't even really want to make this kind of tone or use this type of tone in his films. So there's nothing as excruciatingly tense as a Tarantino film, but there's also this nonchalant playfulness that is also lacking in Tarantino's films. To this day, I think this is one of his most beloved films among his fans. And another thing that he has made a signature to most of his films, and something that I think is uniquely his, he makes it look easy so that he doesn't get credit for it, which is also his ability to have a very twisty, convoluted plot, to rewind action sequences, rewind time periods, inject important, relevant information in the plot as needed. And sure, Tarantino has done this, Danny Boyle has done this, many other filmmakers have done this, but the fluidity of it and the simplicity of it. And honestly, when you watch a Guy Ritchie film, it's as if you are constantly confused as to what's actually happening in the plot. But in the end, it will all be made clear. And it truly is clear. It's very easy to follow in the end. So it is, in some ways, maybe Diet Cola to what Tarantino does, let's say. But sometimes that's what you want. And as I mentioned, there are so many knockoffs of this style that are incomprehensible and tedious and convoluted. And his style is simultaneously very flashy, very energetic, but very easy to follow. After the surprising success of that first film, he had a big fan in the United States in Brad Pitt, who was trying to change the type of roles he had been taking. And coming off of Fight Club and right before his comedically deadpan performance in the Ocean's films, which really rejuvenated his career to a large extent. Right in between there, he did Snatch in 2000. For me, this is still Ritchie's best film. As is the case with so many of his films, I couldn't tell you what happened in the plot now that I've seen it, but there are so many funny sight gags. There are so many clever executions of these fights in the ring and out, and such a simple camaraderie among the cast, which features Benicio del Toro, Dennis Farina, Vinnie Jones, of course, Brad Pitt, of course, in a small role, but very, very memorable. So what if it's all pointless? And once again, this would be maybe my biggest critique of Ritchie, that there's a lot of style. There's a lot of just cool oozing off the screen. Honestly, most of these actors is something that I think that's why it continues to attract high caliber talent emerging and already at the top of their game. Because honestly, he writes characters that accentuate all the coolness of that particular actor. And everybody is just so memorable in this particular film, even if it doesn't add up to really anything at all. Now, after 2000, this is when things get very rough for his career. Two significant things happen. One, he gets into a very famous relationship with Madonna. They marry, have children, and Matthew Vaughn leaves as his producer. He makes his biggest budget movie, the Swept Away film starring Madonna, and it is a catastrophic disaster. The fact that Madonna, near the peak of her career resurrection, in this very public relationship, marriage with Guy Ritchie, and even with the notoriety of the production of the film, could not gross even a few million dollars worldwide, just speaks to how absolutely disastrous this film is. He follows that up with an even stranger decision, a film called Revolver. This film is almost a complete failure. However, if you are a Guy Ritchie fan, you should track it down. I think it's very easy to stream. Also, if you're a Jason Statham fan, because Statham gives a really excellent performance here in this attempt to be taken seriously, to add some gravitas or depth to his work, he makes this very esoteric set in the universe of his previous gangster films, but just dark and violent and illogical and really just about these philosophical questions. The film makes almost no sense at all, but I still admire it for his ambition here, although mostly failing, but the greediness of the film looks great, has some pretty good action sequences and great performances across the board. If only it made any sense at all. This was his most expensive film at the time and another huge flop. And less than a year later, he followed up with Rock and Rolla, another gangster film, very much more in line with his earlier films. This is very much an also-ran. He has still not recaptured the magic of those early two films, but there are some very fun performances here. Gerard Butler, Tom Hardy stands out here before he emerges as a huge star. Idris Elba, Thandi Newton, Mark Strong, just some of the other cast members here. And it's in the trajectory of his career, this was him moving back into a more successful realm, but very much a less successful, less captivating version of those first two gangster films. As I mentioned before, Matthew Vaughn had left the fold to go out and become a director himself. And talk about opposite trajectories. As Guy Ritchie's career was going down in flames and he was struggling to even get his next film off the ground, Vaughn had directed Layer Cake with a pre-James Bond Daniel Craig, which, once again, talking about just displaying someone at their full charisma, this film got Craig his James Bond role, a minor hit in the US, another one of these cult films, but a huge hit internationally. And he followed that up in a very different vein, a fantasy film, surprising how strong visually this film is with someone who's had such little experience with special effects at that time, a film called Stardust. And I really very much love this charming fairy tale. If you're looking for a Princess Bride-like film in a new era, this is probably it. It was very well regarded critically and financially was a solid hit. And then he followed that up with the comic book adaptation Kick-Ass, which performed well enough to get a sequel, but probably underperformed a little bit. However, it has a very strong and vocal fan base. So as Matthew Vaughn continued to work on larger and larger budgets and higher profile of films, Guy Ritchie had two huge disasters in a row. And returning to his original genre had only been modestly successful. But that was all about to change. Somehow, and I still don't know how, despite his multiple failings, he was picked as the director of a very high-profile film, the Sherlock Holmes adaptation in 2009, with Robert Downey Jr. coming off of his Iron Man success. And this film was a phenomenal success, making over $500 million worldwide. It was also well-reviewed by critics, And I really like this adaptation. I think Downey Jr. and Jude Law have great chemistry. I think Downey's having a great time in the role. And I like the steampunk visual styling of turn of the century London. I like the slow motion boxing and action sequences. I really like this very much. And it showed that Ritchie could play in the big leagues. He could be a gun for hire that still brings a unique style to a film. Hot on the heels of that film, they got an immediate green light for the next film. And within 2 years, another Sherlock Holmes film was out, and yet another huge success, over $500 million worldwide. This is the one time when both of these filmmakers' careers are on the upswing. Because in 2011, Matthew Vaughn gets the opportunity to reboot X-Men with X-Men First Class, which is very well regarded critically and by fans, and was a solid hit as well for a franchise that seemed to have lost its cool. Matthew Vaughn's career continued on the upswing as he had the comic book adaptation of Kingsman, The Secret Service, a huge financial success, which also spawned the sequel, The Golden Circle, much less successful. For me, I found the first film a bit grating overall, but still great fun at its best, whereas I found The Golden Circle absolutely terrible, almost from beginning to end. Audiences were more forgiving and did make both of these films pretty big hits. And as is usually the case with these two filmmakers, as he continued this hot streak, Ritchie hit another cold patch, first making, probably to this day, still my favorite of all his films, his Man from U.N.C.L.E. adaptation, starring Henry Cavill and pre-controversy Armie Hammer, along with Alicia Vikander and Elizabeth Debicki, with great supporting work from Hugh Grant as usual. This adaptation of the old British spy show is just an absolute blast. If you haven't seen it, it is so much fun. It's so stylish. Perfectly captures the style of that hipster era of London. But when it came out, it just kind of flopped. Eventually having pretty strong legs, word of mouth is probably pretty decent once it hit theaters. But on a $75 million budget, a worldwide gross of just a little over $100 million was not enough to turn a profit. And it's too bad, because this is really much more of what I want to see Guy Ritchie doing. And maybe he's figuring that out as well. We'll get around to that soon. But if The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was a disappointment, perhaps a hoped-for franchise here didn't end up happening, but there was enough goodwill where people still rumored that there was a chance it might happen for even years afterwards. Obviously, with Armie Hammer's issues now, it will never be the case. But that didn't compare at all to the absolute disaster of his next project, the 2014 King Arthur film called The Legend of the Sword. This was supposed to be the first of 3 to 5, I forget how many movies they were planning for this. They spent an absolute fortune on it, well over $150 million. It was a disaster, losing somewhere between $100 and $150 million. It was one of the biggest money losers of the decade, and obviously never to be a franchise. This is a pretty boring retelling of the King Arthur film. The budget is massive and you can see it. And all you have to see, I really highly recommend this, by the way, it's easy to stream this. Watch the first 20 minutes or so where it flash forwards through the entire rise of King Arthur. Literally, it's like a 20-minute telling of a 2 or 3 movie saga recap. It's a very strange choice to make the film this way, especially because these special effects sequences here, you see the war, you see the battles, you see people riding huge elephants, must have cost an absolute fortune just to make this 20 minutes of film. They should have just made that film, to be totally honest. But there's some pretty interesting filmmaking in that opening section of that film. And then somehow, for the second time in his career, failing upwards, coming off of 2 massive failures, Guy Ritchie is handed the Disney Aladdin adaptation from 2019. This film has very little of Ritchie's unique stylistics. It's pretty bland, but it's not terrible. And Will Smith, as the genie, gives a pretty charming performance. But most importantly, for Ritchie's career, this was a massive success, making over $1 billion worldwide. And that very same year, Ritchie made The Gentlemen, a much smaller scale crime story set in England that returns him to his favorite milieu of these criminal gangs operating in London. But in this case, operating a marijuana manufacturing facility right under these ancient family manors in England. And of course, if you've seen the Netflix series, which we'll be discussing in just a few more minutes, you know that these are very related. The Gentlemen, the film, which came out right before the pandemic lockdowns, was the most successful of all of these smaller scale gangster films that he'd been working on from the beginning of his career. Ritchie was able to also thread in some satire or maybe even social commentary about this corruption of this wealthy class of these British families. and the film was another huge hit. On a $22 million budget, it made $115 million, and soon thereafter, Netflix optioned it for its remake. And of course, if Ritchie was on a hot streak, Matthew Vaughn was probably in a cold streak. The Golden Circle had been a modest success, but audiences had not been that enamored with it, and neither were critics. And he went back to the well with a prequel, The King's Man, which also had mediocre reviews and was a flop at movie theaters. Of course, this was during the pandemic, so attendance was dampened by that. But I don't think anybody was that excited about continuing this franchise, which nonetheless has two more films on the way. Now, at this point, Ritchie does something truly bizarre. Coming off of the massive worldwide success of Aladdin, and then the personal success of The Gentleman, a reclamation of his old style that turned out to be much more financially successful than anybody expected, he made a very interesting choice to just start churning out films. Just one after the other after the other. During the pandemic, he worked with Statham again, his favorite leading man, in a much grimmer revenge thriller called Wrath of Man, a huge hit, which premiered in theaters and available for digital download simultaneously because of the pandemic, and nonetheless made over $100 million worldwide, and more than that on its home streaming, although numbers are not available. A huge financial success for him. And then in 2023, within just weeks of each other, put out another spy thriller, Ruse de Guerre, also with Statham, which had a very limited release in the US, got pretty bad reviews by his standards at this point. I believe did pretty well on digital here in the US, but was a solid hit overseas. And then just a few weeks later, his Afghanistan set, The Covenant, Guy Ritchie's The Covenant is the full title. First time his name is in the title. And this film was also not a huge financial success, bigger in the US than it was overseas, probably because of its thematic elements. But it was also released on Amazon Prime soon after its theatrical release. So probably a success as far as Prime is concerned. And for me, this is a positive step in his career. It got good reviews, by the way, when it came out. But for me, it's not what I want from Ritchie. He provides a, honestly, very effective, well-made, well-paced military thriller. It has some social commentary about the way we abandoned these translators back in Afghanistan when we pulled out, the United States, that is, and the Brits. But I feel like this is one of those straight-to-Redbox set Afghanistan thrillers with better performances. We have Jake Gyllenhaal giving a great performance and Dar Salim very memorable as his translator. But for me, it just didn't have enough of the flair that I expect from a Guy Ritchie film in its dialogue or in its action. Obviously, can't really get away with that given the more serious tone here. But I still think it's a smart move for Ritchie to make a film like this. He can just prove that he can do straight action if he needs to. It's just not what I necessarily think he should do. And that leads us to this moment where Matthew Vaughn puts out the absolute disaster that is Argylle. As I mentioned before, now available for everybody to watch on Apple TV. I do not recommend this film. It's not even bad enough to be entertaining. I'll break down in a review shortly. And simultaneously, on the upswing once again, Guy Ritchie having the massively successful The Gentleman Netflix series. And just last week, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which appears to be, given its budget and its initial box office, is probably going to be pretty modest, maybe a break-even type situation. But this film is a total blast. So it's really what I like the most in Ritchie's films. And from a technical standpoint, maybe the most well-directed film he's ever made. Let's start with the positive. The adaptation of The Gentleman for Netflix, which has been very successful, by the way, so we may very well see a second season, has quite a few things going for it. First of all, Theo James, who I had not really seen in anything, but recently was a fan of his in The White Lotus, is in a very different vein here, playing this very upper crust younger son who's inherited his father's estate, only to discover that there is a whole marijuana growing and distributing infrastructure operating literally underground. And not only is it operating here, but it's actually operating in many of these old manor houses around the countryside. A little social commentary here. How exactly are these upper crust people who haven't worked for multiple generations, how are they paying their bills? What if they were all in cahoots with the criminal underground? You could make some commentary here about the straight-laced conservative upper crust and how they actually benefit from this criminal underground, or how they're all criminals maybe in the end. There's a little subtext here, but mostly this is just a lot of fun. And I was just having a conversation recently about how interesting it is that I had this big complaint, especially on this podcast where I talk about television shows, that so many people have forgotten how to make TV, the old school TV that made you just want to watch the next episode, the characters you fall in love with over time, and just the little hook at the end of one episode that kind of hooks you into the next, and how difficult that has become. And then I was watching two shows that were doing it really well in two completely different veins. One was Shogun, which of course just wrapped up, which is dense and historical and full of impressive vistas and great performances and often massive battle sequences, but knows how to take this giant sprawling story and spread it out and keep it intriguing and having little mysteries that get resolved from episode to episode. And that's how you tell a large story over 10 episodes. And very much in a different vein, The Gentlemen, the first four episodes specifically of this short season, felt like old school TV to me. There was a situation that needed to be resolved in the course of the episode. And Theo James' character, Eddie, is extremely adept at being able to pull himself out of a sticky situation. And the episode would wrap up, but there would be an escalation. Now there's a bag of money that got him out of situation one, but now he has to deal with this bag of money, or now he owes somebody else some money. He's unraveled an even higher level of this conspiracy. And this is all happening in this very high stakes. Every single episode, the threat everybody's under goes up and up and up. And yet the tone is so fun and frothy, and the characters are so likable. Except for Freddy, I really did not like this character, I have to tell you. But other than that, a really lovable crew. Things get darker, they get a little more serious in the back half of the season. I definitely preferred the first half to the second half, but still definitely recommend this series and would look forward to more of these characters. But in the first half, which most of those episodes were directed by Richie himself, I was watching it thinking like, wow, this is what TV can be, right? You just have a little mission you go on every single week and you laugh along the way. And just when you think everybody's in the clear, things get even worse. This is a formula, a great formula for a potential episodic serialized series. And it paid off. I think this has been one of the bigger hits this year for Netflix. And I wouldn't be surprised at all to see more seasons of this show. Also on the positive front, his latest theatrical release, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Henry Cavill here is a criminal who is recruited by an upstart British military group who include Ian Fleming, later to write the James Bond novels, during World War II. And this is actually based on historical events very, very loosely. These secret agents are to cross neutral waters into Spain to sabotage a giant ship which is being used to stockpile all the U-boats in the German-controlled waters, and actually as they're expanding. This actually did happen, by the way, and there are some minor facts that are true, like the exploding of the anchor and the stealing of the ship, but I think the entire mission took about half an hour. The operation, as in the movie, is called Operation Postmaster, and you can look it up historically. As I mentioned, very little violence did occur during this actual mission, although all these men represented here in this film did actually die during the war, so during other missions, much more risky ones, I assume, they did give their lives for their country. But this film takes the bare bones of that mission, some of the historical figures' names, some of the members of this council who organized this criminal group, the overall result of this mission. But then it uses all of that to basically create a Inglourious Basterds light version. And I don't even mean that in a derogatory way. Just like good television with The Gentlemen, I honestly could see this being a television series where you could have a different mission these guys go on every single season, and especially with this cast. Henry Cavill, once again, often misused in many of his roles, especially with an US accent. Maybe that's what flattens him as a performer oftentimes, but so charming with this very posh accent in this particular film. And once again, used so well in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. So Richie really knows how to use his appeal. And with his main sidekick here, Alan Richardson, who of course has become very famous from his Reacher performance in the past couple of years, just hilarious here with this Swedish accent, just this giant brutish monster, literally at one point, bloodily hacking at people with an axe, and then just turning and smiling and waving to his friends. Just every time he's on screen, pretty much comedy gold. And I honestly thought season two of Reacher was kind of dull, especially his performance there. Did like season one, not so much season two. Never finished it, although maybe it gets better. I have many things to say about that season of TV and why they even bothered not keeping it as this incredible Hulk analog, in and out of town, rescuing people. So that's a whole side conversation. But whereas I don't feel they really used his charisma fully there, And I felt he was limited after I've seen him in Reacher, although I like him in that role. This really shows that he could have a really long career as not just a one-man army, but with his comedy chops, he could really turn into a legitimate action star. And if you want to continue the Inglourious Basterds correlations here, we have not only this bearish character, we have this illicit mission of killing Nazis. We have a Hans Lanza-like antagonist, although nowhere near as charismatic as that character. And Aza Gonzalez playing a seductress would-be double agent here. So none of this is as good as Inglourious Basterds. But as I mentioned, in this particular case, Inglourious Basterds Light is a lot of fun and could easily turn into a franchise if they wanted to. I don't think it's going to make enough money for that to happen, but stranger things have happened. And for me, as far as Ritchie's direction goes here, I thought that The Covenant, for example, was a smart move in his regard for him because it showed that he could do straight action without all the additional bells and whistles and the flashbacks and flash forwards and hyper-stylized camera movements. There is one psychedelic sequence where Jake Gyllenhaal's character is drugged out and has some stylistic camera movements and choices. But in general, it is pretty straightforward. But I thought it was a little generic, honestly. I could picture many other directors making a film that way, in that style. Whereas, for example, I can't imagine the first Sherlock Holmes movie made by anyone else. And as I mentioned earlier, this might be one of his most well-directed films, if not his most well-directed. It's not only the scope of the action, it's not only the performances, it's not only that balancing act of taking the material just serious enough, but still allowing us to laugh at all the comedy here, and there's a lot of comedy there, but it doesn't have a lot of the pyrotechnics and the clever CGI-assisted camera movements and time jumpings, and yet provides a very signature style. So I think he is developing his style in an interesting way, especially in this new film. And that leads us to the bad, the very bad. Matthew Vaughn's film, Argyle, is so misbegotten, I can't even understand what the thought process was to bring this thing to light. The fact that I would assume Apple was trying to court him for this theatrical release as a way to show that they are willing to spend money to put these big films into theaters. And of course, they did it with Killers of the Flower Moon, which was a solid box office success, got much Academy Award attention, and had some pretty solid ratings for them on Apple TV+. And then another hugely expensive, around $200 million once again, Napoleon adaptation from Ridley Scott, which once again was pretty solid box office-wise, especially overseas, missed the mark as far as award nominations go, but probably would be considered a minor success for them. And now we have a film that costs $200 million. I can't imagine how this movie costs $200 million, to be totally honest. And I do not think this thing is going to find any kind of new audience for Apple. I mean, they could care less. They're a $3 trillion company, but the product itself is such a disaster from the point of view of why would they make this film, but why would Vaughn be interested in telling this story at all? It's funny to think about when these two men's careers diverged and Ritchie was trying to make different kinds of films and really struggling, whereas Vaughn had made like a better version of a Guy Ritchie film when he made Layer Cake, and then jumped into the comic book film adaptation before it was all the rage, not only with Kick-Ass, but then of course with the X-Men films, and then with the Kingsman films. But whereas I mentioned that Ritchie has really taken his style in a more mature and interesting direction with his most recent film, here we have with Argyle, nothing new under the sun. It is the same cotton-colored, campy action sequences, usually set to disco music. And at this point, it's not even like we're surprised, like for example, with the first Kingsman film, when the film steers into the cartoonish, it is just cartoonish from moment one. And you could picture a modestly charming version of this story where we have Bryce Dallas Howard playing an author who has a very successful series of spy novels. These spy novels actually seem to predict things that actually end up happening in the geopolitical world. And there's a question as to how could she possibly know all of these government secrets? She's on a train early in the film. This is all in the trailer. Sam Rockwell's character sits next to her and informs her that everybody else on the train pretty much is spies who are there to kill her. And he tries to rescue her and she doesn't know whether she should trust them or not. And there's a reveal in the middle of the film or close to the middle of the film which isn't going to really surprise that many people, that she doesn't have the simple biography that we anticipated given the opening sequence of the film. And this reveal, which is not a big reveal if you don't see it coming, and pretty obvious if you do, is treated like a big deal. And I don't even know how someone watching this film is going to engage with it, even if you take it at face value. In a more modest context, this would be relatively charming. But the production values here, this feels like not the new Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which was very good, by the way, but there was like a TV adaptation a couple years ago of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. True Lies got rebooted last year as a TV series. This literally has the level of visual invention and plot mechanics of a television show, like a pilot of a television show. And Sam Rockwell, as usual, is pretty charming in the role, although even he doesn't quite pop. But most of the other performances are pretty flat, pretty generic. There's too many characters. You can't really root for anybody, especially since some of the main characters aren't even aware of their own true backstories. The twist isn't satisfying. And for a $200 million movie, these special effects are absolutely awful. This is some of the worst special effects work I've seen in years. And honestly, some of the special effects in the Kingsman films are also not that great, but those films cost about half as much as this one, so I don't know where the money went. And going back, circling back to the whole idea of Henry Cavill, who has a pretty big part here in this film as well, not made to be as appealing as possible, but honestly, with this bizarre haircut, and this is someone who knows how to wear a suit, by the way, and the fact that he wears suits in this entire film, and he looks terrible in all his suits, it seems to be a choice to make him look this buffoonish, but why hire this actor in this role? It makes no sense at all. And of course, his sidekick is a beefy celebrity himself. It's John Cena, who does absolutely nothing in this film. And I'm not even going to get into the mechanics of the plot that, honestly, as soon as all the pieces are laid out, you just think, this is the most convoluted way you can get to this point. If this was like an actual spy agency, what a wasteful and disastrous set of decisions. And Vaughn has made good films with good scripts. He's written some of these scripts. He didn't write this one, but it's a head scratcher. What was the plan here? Really, what was the plan? So that one, I definitely don't recommend. And as far as their upcoming projects, Guy Ritchie definitely has the advantage here as well. Already completed and planned for release early in 2025 is In the Gray, about a team of special extractors featuring some of his favorite previous cast members. Aza Gonzalez again, Henry Cavill again, Jake Gyllenhaal again. He's also set to direct a theatrical version of The Donovans, the Ray Donovan spinoff movie, and a Fountain of Youth film with Aza Gonzalez again, plus Natalie Portman, John Krasinski, Domhnall Gleeson, and others. He also may direct an Aladdin 2, an Aladdin sequel, a reimagining of Hercules. Some of these projects are more interesting to me than others, but he seems to be continuing to work in material where some of his personal flair accentuates the material, and with budgets that, as far as I can tell, are still relatively modest. If some of these films cost $200 million and made $100 million, they would all be flops, basically, which is maybe something that Vaughn has to think about. As far as his upcoming schedule, two more Kingsman films, a series that already has diminishing returns and are modestly profitable at best at this point. So maybe time for a reframing of his career as well. So that's it for the episode. Do check out my Letterboxd profile. I'll have a list there of all of these films, Guy Ritchie's and Matthew Vaughn's, with ratings and capsule reviews. And if you're curious to see how I rank them all, quality-wise. Upcoming to the podcast, stay tuned. We'll be discussing The Sympathizer, the HBO novel adaptation, prominently featuring Robert Downey Jr., along with a selective filmography of the producer and director of many of the episodes, Chan-Wook Park. Also upcoming, I'm catching up on some of these horror movies that have come out this year. A bit of a disappointing year for horror so far, but there are some interesting topics that I want to discuss here. So expect that in the near future. And also Sona is back from vacation, and I'll be discussing with her a few things we've been watching, continuing to discuss Under the Bridge, the FX true crime mystery series, The Veil, the new Elizabeth Moss spy thriller, which premieres this week, and the return of the Big Door Prize. Plus, there's a new Bluey episode that just dropped this week, and we're always up for discussing Bluey. Also, in the near future, some sci-fi genre mashups: Dark Water on Apple TV, Outer Range on Amazon Prime, and probably next week, a catch-up episode around Colin Farrell's Sugar series, also on Apple TV. So stay tuned for all of that. I'll talk to you soon.